Our scripture reading this evening is from Genesis 26, verse 34, through 27, verse 40. Genesis 26, 34, through 27, 40. And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. And it came to pass that when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his eldest son, and said unto him, My son. And he said unto him, Behold, here am I. And he said, Behold now, I am old, I know not the day of my death. Now therefore take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver and thy bow, and go out to the field, and take me some venison, and make me savory meat, such as I love, and bring it to me, that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee, before I die. And Rebekah heard when Isaac spake to Esau, his son. And Esau went to the field to hunt for venison, and to bring it. And Rebekah spake unto Jacob, her son, saying, Behold, I heard thy father speak unto Esau thy brother, saying, Bring me venison, and make me savory meat, that I may eat and bless thee before the Lord, before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I command thee. Go now to the flock, and fetch me from thence two good kids of the goats, and I will make them savory meat for thy father, such as he loveth. And thou shalt bring it to thy father, that he may eat, and that he may bless thee before his death. And Jacob said to Rebekah's mother, Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. My father peradventure will feel me, and I shall seem to him as a deceiver. And I shall bring a curse upon me, and not a blessing. And his mother said unto him, Upon me be thy curse, my son. Only obey my voice, and go fetch me them. And he went, and fetched, and brought them to his mother. And his mother made savory meat, such as his father loved. And Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them upon Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats upon his hands, and upon the smooth of his neck. And she gave the savory meat and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. And he came unto his father and said, My father. And he said, Here am I. Who art thou, my son? And Jacob said unto his father, I am Esau, thy firstborn. I have done according as thou badest me. Arise, I pray thee, sit and eat of my venison, that my soul, thy soul may bless me. And Isaac said unto his son, How is it that thou hast found it so quickly, my son? And he said, Because the Lord thy God brought it to me. And Isaac said unto Jacob, Come near, I pray thee, that I may feel thee, my son, whether thou be my very son Esau or not. Jacob went near unto Isaac his father, and he felt him, and said, The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy, as his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, Art thou my very son Esau? And he said, I am. And he said, Bring it near to me, and I will eat of my son's venison, and my soul may bless thee. And he brought it near to him, and he did eat. And he brought him wine, and he drank. And his father Isaac said unto him, Come near now, and kiss me, my son. And he came near and kissed him. He smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord hath blessed. Therefore God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be every one that curseth thee and blessed be he that blesseth thee. And it came to pass, as soon as Isaac had made an end of blessing Jacob, and Jacob was yet scarce gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came in from his hunting. And he also had made savory meat, and brought it unto his father, and said unto his father, Let my father arise and eat of his son's venison, that thy soul may bless me. Isaac, his father, said unto him, Who art thou? And he said, I am thy son, thy firstborn Esau. And Isaac trembled very exceedingly and said, Who? Where is he that hath taken venison and brought it me? And I have eaten of all before thou camest and had blessed him. Yea, and he shall be blessed. And when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry, and said unto his father, Bless me, even me also, O my father. And he said, Thy brother came with subtlety, and hath taken away thy blessing. And he said, Is not he rightly named Jacob? For he hath supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he hath taken away my blessing. And he said, Hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? And Isaac answered and said unto Esau, Behold, I have made him thy lord, and all his firstborn have I given to him for servants, and with corn and wine have I sustained him. What shall I now do unto thee, my son? And Esau said unto his father, Hast thou but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac his father answered and said unto him, Behold, thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth, and of the dew of heaven from above. And by thy sword shalt thou live, and shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass, when thou shalt have the dominion, that thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. Thus far the reading of God's holy word. There are a few chapters, congregation, that have more suspense and emotion and excitement in them than this incredible story recorded for us in Genesis 27. But of course, this is much more than a moving and exciting story. It's actually a story with a subject. And the subject is blessing. The word blessing, the Hebrew root word for blessing, is used in this chapter 22 times, 17 times as a noun, 5 times as a verb. So the whole theme of this chapter is obviously the blessing. And it's summarized in the text before us tonight. Verse 33, where we read these words, And Isaac trembled very exceedingly and said, Who? Where is he that hath taken venison and brought it me? And I have eaten of all before thou camest and have blessed him. Yea, and he shall be blessed. Well, obviously this is a very important subject for us still today. How does the blessing of God function in our lives? How does it come into our lives? Why does God bless some people and not others? Can we lose God's blessing by our disobedience? Questions like these are answered, interwoven throughout this story. So with God's help, we want to look with you tonight at this simple theme, blessing or the blessing. And three thoughts. First, the source of the blessing. Second, the sovereignty of the blessing. And third, the spoiling of the blessing. The blessing, its source, its sovereignty, its spoiling. Jacob shall be blessed. That runs throughout this chapter. It's in our text. Isaac regretfully has to acknowledge it. I have blessed him, yea, and he shall be blessed. But why? What's the ultimate reason? What's the source? The underlying cause? Well, the answer is obvious, isn't it? And you know it. It's the will of God. He is the source of all blessing. He will be blessed because God's will and God's purpose is that he will be blessed. Jacob does nothing in this chapter and has never done anything to deserve the blessing. And in a marvelous way, in an amazing way, God overturns Isaac's as well as Esau's connivings, and Jacob gets the blessing. Isaac has his favorite, but God turns it upside down. Well, the chapter begins by telling us that Isaac is old. He does what's right. He's setting his house in order. He's actually 137 here, most commentators think. His brother Ishmael had died 14 years earlier. He was going to live for another 43 years. He didn't know that. He thought he was facing imminent death, but he would live to actually be 180. He wouldn't die until chapter 35. But it's wise, isn't it, to set your house in order, because you really don't know when you're going to die. Today we would say Isaac was drawing up his will like we should do. He was getting things ready. So he says to his son Esau, that my soul may bless thee before I die. Go make me some venison. You know the kind of venison I love. Take your bow and your arrow and go out and shoot something and bring it back to me. Cook it up the way I like it. And Esau enthusiastically agrees. He wants the blessing. He forfeited it once for a mess of pottage. But it's great. And it seems his father is forgotten. And he might get the blessing after all. And so he departs quickly. He who once despised his birthright now wants the blessing back. But it wasn't meant to be. You see, God stands behind every detail of this story. Romans 9:13, Paul quotes Malachi in Malachi 1:2 saying, I have loved you, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord? Yet I loved Jacob and I hated Esau. God has chosen Jacob sovereignly, graciously. You remember the message to Rebekah, even before they were born, the elder shall serve the younger. This is God's purpose. It's not Isaac's wish. It's not Esau's wish. In a sense, it's not even Jacob's wish. It's God's purpose. Jacob doesn't get blessed because he wishes to be blessed. Paul puts it this way in Romans 9. It was said unto her, the elder shall serve the younger. So then it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. So it doesn't depend, you see, on man's desire, man's effort, but on God's mercy. What a ringing endorsement of the sovereign, free mercy of the triune God. That God's decree stands opposed to Isaac's wishes and planning and Esau's longing. That's still true today. All blessing that comes to us from the gracious mercy of the Lord. And so Isaac, in spite of himself, is compelled to pronounce a blessing on the man whom God chooses, who's the opposite one of what he chooses. You see how God overrules everything. Man proposes. God disposes. And so Isaac pronounces the blessing in verses 28 and 29. He gives to Jacob the blessings of prosperity and preeminence and protection. When he finds out what he's done, he's appalled. He's horrified. He trembles very exceedingly. It's the strongest possible word used in the Hebrew language. He's overwhelmed as he realizes that God trumped his sinful, schematized planning. And he's actually forced to worship and to submit and to say to Esau, I have blessed him and indeed he shall be blessed. So here's the source, the will of God, the purpose of God, the mercy of God. And if you belong to Christ, this truth ought to bring you to humility and to thankfulness tonight. Because if you've been blessed by Christ, you know deep down that it has nothing to do with you. It was simply the will and the purpose and the mercy of God. God's decree, God's grace, not anything you are or anything you have done. It's not our goodness or our praying or our law keeping or our piety or our efforts or our background. It is God's free sovereign mercy. I will have mercy on him whom I will have mercy. This is a ringing endorsement through the commentary we have on Genesis 27 and Romans 9 of the sovereign grace of God. That touches the hearts of God's people and makes them bow in gratitude and hopefulness. Because if God does it for me, he can do it for my spouse, he can do it for my children, he can do it for my grandchildren, he can do it for my parents. This is hopeful, you see. Election is not our obstacle. Election is our friend. Election encourages us. Election moves us to prayerfulness. That God will fulfill his own will, his own purpose, his own kingdom. And that God will change every unconverted relative we have and friend we have to know the Lord in truth. Oh, what a blessing that God takes reasons out of himself to bless. What an encouragement. What an encouragement for you parents who have children right now of whom you have to shake your head and say, I'm afraid they're going the wrong way. I'm afraid they show no concern for their souls, no interest in the things of the gospel. God has chosen them. He'll bring them back. Pray for him to bring them back. Persevere. He's done it for others. Why can't he do it for you? He can change them. He can bring them to himself. The source of blessing is always God. Soli Deo Gloria. But notice, secondly, this wonderful sovereignty in this blessing. We need to spend a bit more time here. This is remarkable. God is sovereignly blessing this family in the midst of very shameful and unworthy behavior. There's not one admirable character in this entire chapter. What we're looking at here is what we call in modern day a dysfunctional family. There's lots of codependency going on here. Problems galore. This is a family where relationships have broken down into bitterness and alienation. There's a widespread moral collapse. Even in the family, the one family known to God on the earth, was in the covenant line. What a tragedy. Let's look at each of the participants just a moment. First, there's Isaac. He's an old man now. He's been a believer for most of his life. And yet here he appears so immature. His old age is pitiable and shameful. He knew that God said, the elder shall serve the younger. But Esau is his pet. He plays favorites. He must surely have known that Esau also sold his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of pottage. That he had despised his birthright. And he knew what Esau was turning out to be. After all, the last verses of the former chapter that I read to you say that his foreign wives, which he took against their will, the will of his parents, were a continual grief, not just to Rebekah, but also to Isaac. Esau purposely went out of the godly line and brought paganism and corruption into their home. And yet Isaac is so self-centered in his old age. He likes Esau so much because Esau goes out and gets him good food that he submits to his sensual appetite rather than to the will and the mind of God. Isaac's too fond of food. You read in Romans somewhere that we can be gluttons by making a god of our belly. And Isaac was, that was his Achilles heel. He was falling into the sin. And so he undertakes this very shoddy and underhanded plan with Esau. Now the custom in those days, you know, was when someone was going to die, they would gather all their children around them. They would bless them all. But one son would get the first and the greatest blessing, usually, almost always, the oldest son. So probably what Isaac does is he reasons with himself. He tries to reason away God's plan and reason in his plan and say, this is the normal way. This is what people would expect me to do, to bless my firstborn. Yet he doesn't dare tell Rebekah, because he knows he's going against God's will. And he doesn't dare tell Jacob. So he does it privately with Esau. Sneakily. Just Esau and me. A shameful way for a head of a family to behave. And no wonder Rebekah's angry when she eavesdrops and overhears it. She realizes, of course, that her husband, her heroic husband, who loved her so much before, is now working against her and against Jacob and against the will of God, most of all. The hero of Mount Moriah has backslidden into gluttony. Everywhere in this chapter, we smell the kitchen, don't we? We smell the food. Everywhere it's talking about food and preparing venison. Isaac loved Esau, we're told, already two chapters ago, because he did eat of his venison. So, in one way, we ought not be surprised that Esau sold his birthright for a mess of pottage, because he had a poor example in his own dad. His dad was willing to try to trick God and trick his family for one meal as well. Verse 4, make me savory meat, such as I love. Verse 9, I will make thee savory meat for thy father, such as he loveth. Verse 14, his mother made savory meat, such as his father loved. Everywhere, Isaac loved savory meat. Rather than hearing, Isaac loved God. Isaac loved God's will. Oh, this poor man. He's so far from where he ought to be. The whole scene is impregnated with the smell of cooking. What a danger. What a danger as we get older that maybe we lose some of the lusts of the flesh, but we can take on other lusts of the flesh. Sometimes older people take on this very lust, don't they? I remember one lady saying to me one time, I live for food. What a tragedy. My friend, is there any lust of the flesh that you have that you're giving inordinate attention to that is interrupting your walk with God? How critical that we lay aside every weakness and sin that so easily besets us and run the race with patience that is set before us. And don't let our self-discipline, as was the case with Isaac, to collapse. Who would have thought that Isaac, the man who meditated in the field, would think more of food than of God? Then there's Rebecca. At least we have to give her credit in one sense. She wants the will of God to be done. That's a good thing. She wants Jacob to get the blessing because God said Jacob should have the blessing. But there's a problem for Rebekah as well. Jacob was her pet. Her ultimate motive is right. She wants God's will to be done. But she has the temptation that faces all energetic, decisive, and competent people. And that is to take things in her own hands. And to run ahead of the Lord. As Isaac didn't trust the Lord and wanted to change his plan, Rebekah really didn't trust the Lord either. She didn't really think that he could do it. He needed her help. So she won't wait for God. She won't let him bring the blessing. She's going to help God out. You know, there's a lesson here. Strong love can be dangerous. You see, ultimately, Rebekah does what many parents still do today. She puts her love for her son above her love for her God. All throughout this passage, what stares you in the face is Rebecca's concern that Jacob gets the blessing. Yes, that's God's will, but that's in the background in her mind. She won't trust God either. So she cooks up this devious plan. She takes the flesh of young goats and she knows exactly how to make them the way Isaac likes them. She knows the spices he likes. She makes his favorite recipe. She takes kids' skins to cover Jacob's arms and neck in order to deceive her own husband. She dresses Jacob in his best clothes. What an example for Jacob! Is this the way to live in a Christian home? Covering up, game playing? You know what's interesting when you study this chapter carefully? There seems to never be more than two people talking to each other. Did you notice that? This is a fractured, alienated family. First Isaac talks to Esau. Then Jacob talks to Rebekah. Then Isaac talks to Jacob. Then Isaac talks to Esau. Then Esau talks to Isaac. Then Jacob talks to Rebekah. The family never gets together. They never talk through their problems. They never sit down. It's all behind each other's back, hiding things. Isaac doesn't tell his wife what he's planning. She has to eavesdrop. She doesn't tell Isaac what she's planning. Actually, three times, it's rather ominous, three times she says to Jacob, your father, your father, your father. She never says, my husband. It's a sign of breakdown right there, isn't it? A warning. This is the relationship of which we read. Remember how beautiful it was back in Genesis 24. Isaac loved Rebekah, the Bible says. Took her into his mother's tent and was comforted. What's happened? Where has love gone? How have they drifted away from each other? Strangers, hostile, suspicious of each other. What a mess. Anything like that going on in your home? Any secrets shared with certain people behind the back of others? Not good. Not a good sign. What about Jacob? Well, in some ways, he's the most contemptible figure in the whole chapter. He's willing to cheat his old blind father. He doesn't hesitate at the deceitfulness and nastiness of what is proposed. The only objection he raises to his mother's plan isn't because of what God might think of it, but I shall seem as a deceiver and I'll bring a curse upon me. It's all about me. How contemptible. Then he comes into his father's tent and he says, my father. Actually, they're the only two true words he says the whole time. Everything else from there on in is one lie piled on top of another lie. Over and over again. I am Esau. He's not Esau. I've done according as thou badest me. It's not true. I am Esau. Second time. Not true. And then he doesn't even shrink from blasphemy. His dad asks him, how'd you get the meat so quickly? And he says, the Lord brought it to me. See how one sin gets bigger and bigger than the next? Now he's even using God's name to condone his sin. It's a lie straight through his teeth. Sin is like a room. You walk in it, there's always a door on the other end. And it's always open. And it always leads to a bigger room. And then a bigger room. And yet a bigger. There's no end to Jacob's deceit here. It's a disaster in every way. Jacob teaches us here that we have to learn, boys and girls, teenagers, parents, seniors, we have to learn to say no when people present us with sinful plans. The little word no can save us from a very big fall. A very big fall. And then there's Esau. Esau is a person, perhaps when you read this chapter, you might end up having most natural sympathy for Esau. You'll hear him cry. You'll hear his bitter tears. But we really shouldn't feel too sorry for Esau either. Esau had despised his birthright. He did sell it for a bowl of pottage. And he has only himself to blame for all that follows. He's crying now over what he said he didn't want in the past. And don't forget, he was willing to plot in secret against his brother as well. He too knew that his brother had gotten the birthright. He's not seeking God here. He doesn't accept responsibility here for what he's done. Actually, he says in verse 36 of Jacob, "He took away my birthright." Not true. Esau sold it to him. For one bowl of soup. And so Isaac's blessing of Esau at the end of this passage amounts to nothing more than what one commentator calls a modified curse. What a sorry picture Esau is as well. And what a lesson we have to learn from him. We learn this from Esau, that tears are not enough. "Hast thou but one blessing, my father?" He weeps. "Bless me, even me also." But he couldn't alter what happened, you see. He wanted the blessings outwardly, but he didn't want the blesser. He wanted the gifts, but he didn't want the giver. He cried over lost blessings. He didn't cry over his sins. He never broke his heart because he despised the birthright, but only because he would lose what he wanted. See, he never really repented. So the sovereignty of blessing, what does it say behind all this malfunctioning family? Well, it's saying that we never deserve the blessing that God gives. Isn't it amazing that through all this intrigue and deceitfulness and sinfulness, that God just doesn't throw away this family? But sovereignly, he comes and he blesses Jacob, the devious twister. And he calls himself the God of Jacob. He even says in the Bible, "Happy is he who has the God of Jacob for his help." God is willing to come down and change this deceiver. What an encouragement for us when our hearts are so wrong and so twisted and so selfish. God can do the same thing for you, my friend. He can sovereignly, graciously bless you. As an unworthy person, he justifies the ungodly, not the godly. He blesses Jacob, though he doesn't deserve it. He can bless you, though you don't deserve it. That's the beauty of this story, that God carries out his sovereign, gracious purposes despite Jacob. And so there's a prophetic ring to Isaac's testimony in our text. "I have blessed him, and he shall be blessed." It's God speaking behind Isaac, giving us the meaning, as Romans 9 shows us, to this entire story. And yet, despite the source of blessing and the sovereignty of blessing, this blessing was greatly impacted for ill by the behavior of this family. It was spoiled in some very real ways. It wasn't lost completely, but it was spoiled in some very real ways. It doesn't mean that sin doesn't matter. Sin does matter. And sin can put large blots on the blessings of God. It can spoil them in notable ways. And you see that here. And in subsequent chapters. I will leave aside Esau for a moment, because Esau sinned himself outside of the covenant line anyway. But Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob all had to endure consequences from this dysfunctional behavior, in which they spoiled much of the blessing. Isaac, well, if we give him the benefit of the doubt, perhaps he does change a bit for the better after this shock of God's turning his devious plan upside down. We have two more glimpses of Isaac in the Bible. First, he's finally talking with Rebekah at the end of this chapter. Well, that's a good thing. He's talking with his wife. It's a pity they hadn't talked a great deal more earlier. And then in the next chapter, we see that he warns Jacob not to follow Esau's example and marry a Canaanite. Too bad he didn't warn Esau earlier more. And he gives him the blessing of Abraham. But that is to Jacob. But there's nothing more. And there's something kind of eerie about this, that Isaac lives for over 40 more years and you just don't read anything about him. And then suddenly in chapter 35, he dies. And you say, oh yeah, Isaac's been alive all this time. Where's he been? What's been going on? We don't know. Now, we can never argue from silence, but it seems, doesn't it, that his life is rather insignificant those last decades. How would you like to live the last two or three decades of your life in relative insignificance? There seems to be some consequences to his careless living. Rebecca loses both of her sons. She thought to help the Lord along, but she ends up losing both of her sons. Esau, not only, but even Jacob. She never sees him again. And she too drops out of the picture. We're not even told when she dies or where she dies. And ironically, we're told about the death of her nurse rather than her own death. We're just told at the end of Genesis that Rebekah had died. She vanishes into apparent insignificance as well. Jacob, what consequences he faced? He has to leave his home. He has to leave the promised land. He has to go into exile and serve long and hard years in exile. And here's the irony and justice of it all. Jacob, the cheater, is going to be cheated by his uncle Laban over and over and over again. He's going to have to learn what it means to be cheated against. He who deceived his blind father is going to participate in a blind marriage. And he'll find out in the morning that he's married to the wrong person. Our sin has consequences, even if we are the sovereign recipients of the blessings of God. The comfort, of course, is that if we are Christians, we can't lose God's ultimate blessing. We can't lose our salvation. We can't lose heaven. But we can certainly spoil our enjoyment of life upon this earth. We can spoil our usefulness on this earth. How sadly possible it is for true Christians to behave in foolish and sinful ways, to damage and disrupt their marriages, to damage their children, to lose the peace of their own hearts, to stop living with a concrete, single-eyed purpose, to live to the glory of God, and to complicate, make a mess of their lives and start building up bitter regrets and be sidelined from God's significant purposes. And their lives often can devolve into insignificant, meaningless, humdrum, daily pursuits without spiritual communion with God, without being a great blessing to others. Oh, how sin can drag us down. Jacob was impacted. Isaac is impacted. Rebecca is impacted. But you and I are impacted by sin as well. And this is such a tragedy, you see, because if you're a true believer, you want more than heaven. You want more than having your soul to be saved, don't you? You want a meaningful life, don't you? You want to be fruitful. You want to be God-honoring. You want to serve to the glory of God. You want to make a difference with the people around you. You want your life to be salt in the earth and light on the hill. You want to show, as David put it, the beauty of the Lord. We don't want to live lives without significance if we're believers. We want divine blessing that pours itself out like oil over us and upon us by the Spirit of God, and we go out to be blessed and be a blessing. That's what's so beautiful about the original Abrahamic blessing. I will both bless thee and thou shalt be a blessing. That's what a believer wants. To be a blessing to others, richly, fully, continuously, everywhere. Not just for myself, not just for my family, but wherever I go, I want to touch other people's lives with the blessing of the Most High. But you can't do that very easily in a dysfunctional family. So let me use the rest of the time tonight to... I've been making, I hope, practical applications, but now I want to take them and I want to bring this right into your home, to my home. And we want to look at 6 home problems and their remedies and talk to ourselves heart to heart a bit here. Because we need to understand that we can retain, by the grace of God, we can retain God's blessings relatively unspoiled if we avoid these kinds of home problems that did so much damage in Isaac's family. Let me give you 6 of them. First, an unconverted child. That was the first difficulty. Esau, and maybe Jacob, there's debate about when Jacob was converted, but certainly Esau, we know that for sure, had not come to faith. And he would live and he would die graceless. What a trial that can be. And how much a restless, unconverted child like Esau can upset a home in which most of the people want to be God-fearing. What a struggle. Maybe you have that problem in your own home today. You've got one or more unconverted children who are always, by word, by conversation, by behavior, by body language, always seeming to push away the fear of God. And they seem to resist that wonderful Puritan model that our homes should be little churches. How painful this is. Painful to see our children go astray. Painful to see that they don't want to walk in the ways of God. If John said, I've got no greater joy than to see my children walk in the truth. Certainly there's no greater sorrow than to see our children not walk in the truth. So this is a very real experience, not just for Isaac and Rebecca, but no doubt for many, many of us in this church building tonight. What can we do about it? Well, we can't just walk out of this building tonight, can we, and convert our children. Can't do that. But you can pray. You can teach. You can be an example. You can press on. You can believe in the covenant faithfulness of God. You can hope in the power of God. You can trust yourself and your children to the covenant faithfulness of God, that it's His normal way to work along covenantal lines and covenantal children. Don't give up on the Lord. He's sovereign in His blessing. He's covenantal in His character. You have every reason to hope that as you nurture your children in the ways of God, now or later, God will bless it. So press on. Press on. Do your very best to give your children, regardless of age, right teaching and right living and examples. Who knows? Maybe 10 years from now, they'll come back to you and they'll say, I want to thank you, Dad and Mom, for not letting me go my own way. Thank you for your example. Thank you for the fear of God you showed me. I saw reality of religion in you, even though I kicked against the pricks for a while. You see, expect God to work. And if and when you do see fruits, don't discourage those fruits. Be hopeful. Don't lay your hands directly and say, oh, at the first sign, the first fruit, this is it. This is everything. Don't do that. You can bring the venison too quickly. But do encourage your children as they seek the Lord. Don't dampen God's own work by digging too tenderly near a small plant. I once visited an old elder. He was telling me the story of another elder who had a child who was beginning to fear the Lord, but the child was still engaged in a few things that were a little bit risque. And that elder refused to believe God was at work at all in his child. And the one elder said to the other one, I've learned not to dig too deeply near a tender plant. God may be working in your children even now. You may see a few signs of it, a few other things that trouble you. Wait on God. Keep teaching. Keep waiting. Avoid presumptive regeneration on the one hand, but also avoid presumptive unregeneration on the other. Keep bringing them the marks of grace. Who can tell what the Lord will do? Problem number two, unbridled rivalry. Oh, what a problem this is. Two children at each other's throats under one roof. Esau and Jacob never seemed to get along. In fact, we read in Genesis 27 that Esau would have killed Jacob if he could. What a sad situation. Some of you know what that's like. Maybe not that extreme, but sibling rivalry in the home. How sad, boys and girls, when brothers and sisters don't get along. What a grief you can be to your mom and to your dad when you're always at each other's throats, always saying hard words, always teasing each other cruelly. How unchristian, how ungodly a home can be. And one brother or one sister is always teasing the others. How discouraging. What are we to do? Well, yes, exercise patience. Yes, persevere in discipline. Yes, keep correcting. But remember, God is a sovereign God of blessing. Take comfort from this, knowing that God knows your trials. He sees the incompatibility between some of your children. And He can make it right. He can bring them to maturity. He can bring them to exercise more love. Keep giving an example yourself and pray. Pray to the sovereign God, the source of all blessing, to resolve this problem. Problem number three. Unequally yoked children. What a problem this was. Genesis 26, 34, 35. Esau purposely went out and took Hittite women. Not one, two. And they were a continual grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. Esau knew very well, both from Abraham's example, as well as from his parental teaching, that he should marry within the godly circle. Abraham had set a beautiful example. He had said to Isaac, don't, or rather his servant, don't take from among the heathen around here, don't take a wife for my son Isaac. What fellowship does light have with darkness? Or the temple of God with idols, or heaven with hell. There's incompatibility at the deepest level between the ungodly and the godly. And yet Esau, in his selfishness and his carnality and his sensual lusts, he was a thoroughly worldly man. He just went right ahead. He chose to disregard all this teaching. He went right ahead. Dear singles, I say to you tonight, don't follow Esau's footsteps. Don't allow yourself to even think about developing a relationship with anyone who does not have a deep respect for and a love of the faith of the gospel. Marry only in the Lord. Fourth problem, unnerving infirmities. Isaac is old. We have a picture here of an old man, a blind man. The shadow of death is upon him. How unnerving that can be. When people get old and infirmities trouble them, I often say to our seniors, I've said it to some of you, that's not easy to be old, is it? And every one of you have said to me, who are old, right away, no, it's not. It's not easy. To lose your hearing, to lose your sight, to lose your ability to move about, to lose driving privileges. It's unnerving. And yet this is reality. God's people are not exempt from pain and infirmity and disablement and old age, and blindness and deafness and loneliness. So what are we to do about this? Well, two things. First of all, make sure that we make the best possible use of our faculties while we have them. What are you doing now with your eyes? What are you doing now with your ears? What are you listening to? What are you looking at? What are you doing now with your hands? What are you doing now with your feet? What are you doing now with your mind? You thinking on good things? The second thing is this. Have compassion. Jacob and Esau and Rebekah all should have had compassion on Isaac. Have compassion and show special kindness to your parents or your grandparents or to those in the church who have age and infirmities against them. And show special kindness to those who are losing various faculties. Or maybe in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's or losing their hearing or their sight. One day you may be a senior as well. You may lose some of your faculties. You may deeply appreciate thoughtfulness from others. Remember, you see, these afflictions don't happen outside the home. They happen in the home. Let us treat one another in the home with great love. Especially when there are infirmities present. Problem five, an uninhabited home. Uninhabited home. The problem of a child away from home, in other words. Esau left, and Jacob had to leave. Jacob had to go to Padan Aram. There he found a wife. But he wouldn't return for 20 years. Never saw his mother again. What a burden! We live in a mobile society today. Children often leave home very early. We at least ought to think twice before we send them away early. Are they strong enough to withstand temptation in a distant college? Perhaps they are. Is there a good church in that city? Perhaps there is. Well, that makes it more palatable. But do remember, it's always good and wise to consider these things. Don't send your children away from your home lightly. You lose a lot of influence. God can take care of them wherever He sends them. Of course, He took care of Jacob away from home in a marvelous way. But don't be in a hurry to push your children out of the nest. I think that's the biblical teaching here. Problem six. Uncommunicated games. This is the real problem. This is the ultimate problem of this home. Everybody's playing games with everybody else. Isaac has his scheme. Rebekah has his scheme. Isaac schemes with Esau. Rebekah schemes with Jacob. It's one against another. All playing games. No one being open. These things are written for our learning, the New Testament says. We must strive to learn to live harmoniously together, to live openly, to talk about differences honestly. Game playing must stop. Wife and husband ought to be able to look each other in the eye, 6 inches away from each other and be fully transparent and honest and open and speak from heart to heart about their greatest problems, their deepest joys and fears and sorrows. We must strive as parents to be models of openness and affection toward our partners and in our family. This is the only way to build a relationship, a family, of trust. Trust is the foundational element, isn't it? Of a family that God sovereignly blesses with closeness and intimacy. See, my point here is that ultimately there was a spiritual problem in Isaac's home. And the spiritual problem becomes a practical problem. The spiritual problem is they don't trust God. And the practical problem is therefore they don't trust each other. See, Isaac didn't trust God. He wanted Esau to be blessed. I'll do it my way. Rebecca didn't trust God. Well, yes, Jacob would be blessed, but I'll help God along. Neither one of them trusted God. Esau didn't trust God. He wasn't even thinking about God. Jacob didn't trust God. I don't see anyone to put on the hairy skin. None of them were trusting God. And when you don't trust God, how can you trust each other? The vertical relationship we have with God always impacts the horizontal we have with one another. So Isaac doesn't trust Rebekah. Isaac doesn't trust Jacob. Notice how he keeps saying, come near to me, kiss me. Smells him. Are you really Jake? Are you really Esau? You've got the voice of Jacob. You've got the skin of Esau. Doesn't trust him. Doesn't trust him for good reason. Rebecca doesn't trust Isaac. She overhears him. She can't trust Esau either. You see, no one can trust each other. There's a multiplication of distrust. And the foundational problem is spiritual, you see, because no one is trusting the will and the good pleasure of God and putting God at the center of their plans and at the center of their actions. A home that is healthy and not dysfunctional is a home where every member puts God at the center and His will at the center of their desires and their actions. In a godly home, every member can look at one another and give advice to each other by asking the question, what does God want you to do? That's the operative principle of a healthy home. Not what can I get, but what does God want me to do? Well, let me close this sermon then by ending with three comforts. Three comforts. The first is God's promises. Remember, don't forget, even though they spoiled a great deal, God's promises still ultimately went through. God can make crooked sticks straight. God can still take the mess of your home, and He can still bring you great blessing. God is a faithful, promising, covenant-keeping God. He's not done with your family yet. You're still alive. He can still do wonders. He's not finished with your children yet. They're still under your roof. Or if they're not, they're still alive in society. Trust the Lord. Remember the day you brought them for baptism. He said on that day, I'm willing to be their God. I put my triune name beside their name. Plead that. Ask Him to have respect unto His covenant for your children. Second comfort, God's purposes. God's promises and His purposes coalesce, just like His decree of election and His providence coalesce. You see, when God hasn't finished with our families, it means He won't make any mistakes. He'll fulfill His own purposes. And He'll even fulfill them through and despite our mistakes. One thing I always marvel about children, when you go to a child and say, I've been wrong, please forgive me. Children are very gracious and say, yes, of course I'll forgive you, Dad. They're willing to allow that their parents are going to make mistakes. You know, God is the same way. When you come to Him and say, please forgive me for not being the parent I should, Fulfill your loving purposes, Lord, in my children, despite who I am. God will hear such cries. The counsel of the Lord shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Thank God that He's not left His great purposes in our frail hands. Jesus Christ came from this family. God fulfilled His purposes despite Isaac, despite Rebekah, despite Esau, despite Jacob. And He'll do it again. His kingdom shall come. Our duty is to go to Him in repentance where we fail, and then to remain faithful in our callings to Him, and to find comfort in trusting that not one of His purposes shall fail. So there's comfort number two. God's promises, God's purposes. Thirdly, finally, God's prerequisites. God's prerequisites. According to Revelation 7, God's prerequisites for heaven is that all those who will enter in will have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Can't be saved outside of Christ. And they shall have come out of great tribulation. Great tribulation. Do you understand what that means? There are no idyllic perfect homes. There's no idyllic perfect heart. There's no idyllic perfect society. There's no idyllic perfect church. Sometimes Christians get that all mixed up. They're always looking for the church to be perfect, or the minister to be perfect, or the office bearers to be perfect, or their families to be perfect. They're always disappointed with everyone else who's not perfect. But they forget what Spurgeon said to a woman who once came to him and said, "I'm looking for a good church." He said, "Are you looking for a perfect church?" She said, "Yes." He said, "Don't join it. Won't be perfect anymore." You see, we have to look at ourselves, congregation. We will come out of great tribulation into glory. There will be problems. There will be big problems we have to face. There will be afflictions. But God will use those afflictions. God will use those troubles to lead us through them as His appointments, to overrule them and to use them and stand them on their head and bring His promises through them. That's amazing. Think of all the troubles Job went through. He must have thought this will never come out good. And in the end, God gives him double and makes everything well. These are they who have come out of great tribulation. This is like a prerequisite. You've got to know washing your robes in the blood of the Lamb. You can't go to heaven outside of Christ, but you can't go to heaven without troubles either. Because God will break us to save us. God will lead us through thick and thin to glory. That's the way He does it. So, don't expect a perfect home and a perfect family. That's for heaven. A perfect home is coming. The perfect family is coming. The perfect fulfillment of the promises is coming. But it's not here yet. But ask God for a single eye, His name to glorify. Ask for prayer that you may conduct your home the way God would have you to do. But above all, ask God to be true to His promises, true to His purposes, and true to His prerequisites, so that you can see in your family that His covenant will not fail. And it won't fail. He'll go on converting the rising generation until He comes again on the clouds. Happy is He that hath the God of Jacob, the God of Jacob, for His help, whose hope is in the Lord, His God. Amen.